From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, the number to call is 800-462-7413. And along with your calls, we have some topics to talk about, Zorba.
Sure. Caring for caregivers. Caregiver burnout. What can we do about it? And should we anticipate it? What's going on in America today? And calcium and vitamin D supplements may not protect those bones the way you think they should.
And our recipe?
Broccoli with anchovies and garlic. I'm always looking for a new recipe with broccoli because I'm using it with other dishes. I'm looking for something that's tasty, not just steamed, not just boiled. If you like broccoli like I like broccoli, you'll like this recipe.
Okay, to the phones we go now, Zorba, at 800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. And our first caller is with us from Friendsville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
I was wondering if what Zorba's opinion was of the cannabis oils on MS and Parkinson's disease.
Uh-huh. So cannabis oil, there's a lot of information. Well, there's not a lot of information. There's a lot of interest in the use of cannabis. So let's first of all go to the federal government, and let's go back in time to J. Edgar Hoover, who decided that cannabis and heroin were exactly the same. Cannabis was the entry level to heroin and death within our society. And we know that the opioid epidemic is basically streamlined not by marijuana, but probably by opioids prescribed by doctors like myself. I mean, the reality is J. Edgar was wrong, but the federal government has not changed its mind, even though lots of states have allowed medical marijuana, and then you have legalized cannabis in California, Washington, Colorado, and other states will follow. But when it comes to research, it's a whole other thing. The federal government is pretty much refused to allow researchers to use federal dollars to look at things with that because they have, this fear that all of a sudden the whole society is going to be stoned and we're no longer to be productive Americans. So whether or not it works for MS or not, there's no science on it. We just don't know. That's a good question. Now, do you have MS or are you worried about MS?
Yeah. Yeah, I have MS, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you've used it or you haven't used it? What are you thinking
about? Oh, no. Tennessee doesn't allow it yet.
Yeah,
but I just keep hearing about it. Like they claim it's like a panacea. Almost.
No, it's not a panacea. That's for sure. If it were a panacea, then you wouldn't have MS in the 24 or 25 states that allow medical marijuana, and basically there would be a huge movement to allow it. Because right now, for instance, in Wisconsin, it's illegal, except in certain cases, it's a certain type of cannabis oil that can be used in children with epilepsy because it's been worthwhile. There was a special law passed by the legislature specifically for that, and I think specifically for that diagnosis, although I don't quite remember what it is. But getting back to MS and the issues, we don't have, we have medications that work for MS. Are you on any one of them at this time?
Yeah, I'm on Tysabri.
How has that worked for you?
It's worked great.
Well, I mean, the drugs that have been around now for, more than a decade have been very, very useful. And I don't think cannabis is going to supplant them. They've made a useful contribution. So right now, I think the jury's out. We don't have any research on it. It's not a panacea. I doubt very much if it's going to be as good as the drug you're on and the other drugs that are useful for MS because they really change the course of MS. You're functioning how well with your MS?
Oh, I'm pretty good. That's pretty good.
So, yeah. Well, it's not legal in your state, and I have patients in my state, and they say, well, I want to try it for chronic pain. That's the issue.
Right.
And unfortunately, if they want to try it for chronic pain, they either have to go to a state where it's legal and then bring it back, and then it's illegal. And people don't like to do that. They don't want to, especially people who are older. People in their 20s who usually don't have chronic pain are more likely to do it than people in their 60s. I think it should be legalized in the country every state for chronic diseases. It certainly is better than opioids when it comes to chronic pain.
Right.
I mean, the reality is we have 50,000 deaths from opioids, and I, just like other doctors, prescribe them willy-nilly, and the answer is we got a lot of deaths. And you don't get deaths from marijuana, and you don't get bar fights from marijuana either. I've been to Amsterdam. I'll tell you something interesting. In Amsterdam, they have places where you can smoke pot I think they're called cafes. I can't remember what they're called exactly. And then bars. And you're not allowed to drink alcohol in a place where you smoke pot. In other words, you're not allowed to do that. And in bars, you're not allowed to smoke pot. They don't mix it. And when you're outside in the evening in Amsterdam, my wife and I were walking back from the symphony, you just look outside the two buildings and you see complete difference. And the bars are kind of rabble-rousing outside the pot shops and just kind of hanging out and sitting around. So, well, thanks.
Yeah, to the caller. You have MS, and you're treating it quite well, as I hear it. Are you kind of hoping that cannabis is really, really effective for this?
Yeah, I really was. I was hoping that would be the natural way to reduce the inflammation that I thought was what caused MS.
Well, that's it. Unfortunately, even if it were to work to reduce the inflammation, it still inebriates you. In other words, right now, and that's because we don't have research to separate it out. So the cannabis oil that's available still makes you stoned, and that's, of course, like taking an opioid during the day. You can't function the same way. Your mind, your mind is not in the same state as it is when you have coffee, for instance. So.
I see.
Well, good luck. Keep on your medications.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Appreciate the call. Thank you. Okay, Zorba, to kick off our first topic discussion of the show, let's read an email we received from a listener named Dee. She writes, "Zorba, I like your show and the sensitivity you and Tom show to your wide variety of listeners. However, I've listened twice to your segment about being cared for by a loved one during sickness or recovery. Both times, as I listened to you and Tom praise your wives and the care you received, I thought, well, isn't that special? And then you go on to discuss how paid caregivers aren't nearly equal. Listen up, guys. I realize you were reporting research, but it was alarming, not cheery. A follow-up discussion of how people can take care of themselves or arrange for decent care would be a lot more positive and helpful for people who are on their own. So, Zorba, can we discuss how the caregivers can take care of themselves?"
Well, I think that's a really good point from this, and advice taken. That's really important to take it, because there really is caregiver burnout, and caregiver burnout
as anybody can imagine.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. You know, where all of a sudden you don't have any respite, you don't have any, you're the loved one caring for the person, and there's lots of research that shows, ARP has done research on caregiving, for instance, and the National Academy of Science also, that it's really an unsustainable workforce. It's a workforce people often have to take off from their job. They can't do other things. It's financially draining. It's emotionally draining. It's very difficult. Caregivers that are at home are often overworked, underappreciated, families within the health system. And I see this all the time in my practice, where somebody will come in, often with a senior. It's usually a senior who is disabled in one or more major activity of their life. And a lot of the people come in, they'll say, "Well, I've got two brothers and a sister," or something like that. "Do they do anything?" And they don't do very much. In other words, so that it's all on that person. It's not shared within the family for many, many reasons. They might be far away, or they might be close by, or they might be inept, or they might just be lazy. So-and-so is doing it. Why should I do it? Because they're doing it. So it's a problem. And if we stated that a caregiver always is better than somebody who is a paid caregiver, that's really the wrong thing to say. There are many, many paid caregivers who are wonderful, who are kind, do a wonderful job. I had an aunt in Chicago, my favorite aunt, and she was really dying. She really had a hospice, but it wasn't a hospice. She had a wonderful caregiver who was just like a member of the family that was there. So I think we have to start appreciating our caregivers. And also, if you know somebody who's caring for somebody else, you might call them up and say, let me give you a break. You know, because those are exactly the things that can really make a difference.
Yeah, that would really be a nice thing.
Be very nice thing. Very useful, and also very useful for that person. So advice taken. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. 800-462-7413 is our number. That's 800-462-7413. A line open now for you if you'd like to join us. As we go to our next caller now, Zorba, a listener in St. Augustine, Florida. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I'm a 70-year-old, in relatively good health. I have urticaria, and 5 years ago I was diagnosed with the alpha-galactose sensitivity. Mm-hmm. Which changes my diet because all mammals contain that sugar, and it's transmitted by a tick bite from the Lone Star tick. And I work as an arborist, and I'm out in the woods a lot, and it's really hard to avoid, even with extraordinary precautions, it's hard to avoid ticks.
Let me ask you a question. So I'm not familiar with this. Alpha-galactose, where was the diagnosis made? What kind of symptoms did you have?
Okay, well, some people get anaphylactic shock. I'm fortunate. Mm-hmm. I just break out, and it gets very uncomfortable if I don't do anything. The usual antihistamines mm-hmm. don't seem to touch it at all.
So how was the diagnosis made that you had the alpha-galactose?
My allergist.
Your allergist made the diagnosis.
Yeah.
Okay, so
we were kind of hitting a blank wall. You know, mm-hmm. we leave out milk, for example, or some meats, but we didn't know what was causing it. And finally, he said alpha galactose. So any mammalian product such as milk or pork, mm-hmm. or you know, I could eat a primate, I guess, if
primates. but primates are mammalian. I mean,
for some reason, primates don't carry the
sugar.
Yeah,
I don't think you're going to get monkey meat on this show. Let me tell you that much.
Yeah.
That's not. They do eat that in Asia and in Africa, but not here. So, but getting back to this, they made the diagnosis. Do you have an EpiPen with you at all times when you eat out at restaurants?
I do, but I don't carry it around. My reaction is generally 30 minutes after I consume something that I shouldn't have, I mm-hmm. break out.
And Benadryl doesn't help you much? No, Benadryl
doesn't. No. And I've gone through a period when I've taken 8 a day, which does slow you down a bit, and mm-hmm. taken the Claritin 3 mm-hmm. a day, and mm-hmm. It didn't seem to help. The only thing that I get when I get a flare-up is prednisone. I mm-hmm. take a tapered dose, but I'm worried about the prednisone that I'm taking. Occasionally, sometimes there's at least a 10-day spread between when I take it, and sometimes last month it was I went 35 days without having a flare-up.
So you have to take this how often, like in a 3-month period? How often do you take it?
Probably 5 times.
Well, that's a significant amount. But another question, why not? I mean, it may be that you just have to become a vegetarian or a pescatarian, you know, which is vegetables and fish. I mean, fish are not mammals.
Right.
And that's what you have to do. You have to limit yourself and control your food. And when you go to a restaurant, obviously that's the issue, is going out to restaurants. And I'll give a good example. At McDonald's, for a while, I don't know if they're still doing it, for a long time, McDonald's fries actually had some tallow, beef tallow in it. Mm. And it became a huge issue because there were a lot of people, especially in India, who were devout vegetarians, and they found out that there was, you know, beef tallow in the fries, beef fat. And I don't know if they took it out. I think they did, but I'm not 100% sure. So you can't always be sure, but is that when you have your trouble at restaurants? At home, you've got
mostly
control.
I try not to bother the waitress or waiter too much, but my boys have told me, Dad, you gotta explain what you got.
Oh, no, you have to. But they're going to be pretty much, at some restaurants, they'll know what you're doing. At other restaurants, they'll say, sure, we don't have that in this. But the reality is they do, because...
And then I find out 30 minutes later, boom, I got a inflammation starting up. So,
right, exactly. So let me go back a second. So your children, your boys say, Dad, you've got to really question the waitress, and you don't question the waitress because you don't want to bother them?
Well, I'm from Minnesota. does that explain it?
Yes, it does.
I live in Florida, but I'm from Minnesota, so you can't take that out of
me. Yes,
and
it does.
I was taught, don't bother people.
That's right. It's so funny. You know, the definition of a traffic jam in Minnesota is four people at a stop sign. Actually,
and the Minnesota extrovert is they will say nice shoes.
that's exactly it. That's very funny. That's right. Well, you know, you're in Florida. People in Florida are a little more pushy, especially along the Florida coast that comes from New York and New Jersey.
Yep.
So they're a little bit more pushy. So you just have to watch what they say, because believe me, they would question the waitress over and over and over again, and then make sure when it came out that they were right. So you got to take it's hard to take the Minnesotan out of you, but you'll have to try. That's very funny. So,
okay.
Well, I do have one recommendation. Have you taken Zantac along with antihistamines?
Right, I have, and several others like Atarax, different things that do help itching, and none of it really seems to.
Okay. So the answer is question the waitress. Thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you.
We appreciate it at 800-462-7413. And if you're a nice person from New York or New Jersey and want to yell at Zorba.
I did not mean to insult the New Yorkers and New Jerseys. That's right. I'm sorry. Oh, well, generalizations.
Before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's pry open the Zorba Pester on your health inbox and have a look at a listener email. This one came to us from Cindy. Hello, Dr. Zorba and Tom. Please give me guidelines for those happy lights that are used to relieve winter depression. My husband is considering a tanning bed to help him feel better. I am advising him against it, but need an alternative.
Well, first of all, a tanning bed is going to tan you, and we know tanning beds put you at risk for skin cancer. We all know that. And there's not enough light in a tanning bed to actually do this. You need 10,000 lux. 10,000 lux is a measurement of light intensity, and 10,000 lux is the key to it. And there are a lot of lights you can buy on Amazon and other providers. They now come as, last time I looked at an Amazon at the one I like, which is called Lightphoria, Lightphoria. I do not get any money from it. It's the one I use. Mm-hmm. I think it's called Sphere Technologies. I got it in Amazon, and the price dropped now to $35. That's nothing. $35 is really, really a good price. And these lights are bright lights. You use them for 30 to 45 minutes every morning, and they can give you energy. And I find they're very, very useful for me since I started using them. The old lights, not as useful. Hot, the ones that are medically approved are hot because they use a different, you know, they use regular sort of incandescent lights, and they're too expensive, and they're too hot.
Have a healthy living question for us? Zorba will show you the light. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
More of your calls coming up, and our recipe, and our last caller will appreciate this. The recipe has no meat. All coming up on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again, if you have a question for Zorba, and a line is open now for you, 800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call broccoli with anchovies and garlic.
Yes, great recipe. I found this in the New York Times, one of the places I love. I belong to Cooks Illustrated. I look at the New York Times, which has great recipes all the time. And I like this. And I like it because I happen to like broccoli. And I'm always looking for broccoli as a side dish for other things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I get, you know, I just steam it. That's okay. But it's fun to have something that's a little bit more than that. Now, do you like broccoli?
I do like broccoli.
Yeah, I like broccoli. Yeah, it's good. And we've got our granddaughter Bella likes broccoli. She calls it like little trees because they do kind of look like little trees. So she will eat broccoli. So this is a wonderful broccoli. So start out with a bunch of broccoli, about a pound and a quarter.
About a pound and a quarter of broccoli.
Yeah, now one of the things that's nice about it is we're not just going to use the florets. You know, florets are the top of the broccoli. You know, the stems are tougher. We're not just going to use them. We're going to use the whole broccoli.
Oh.
3 tablespoonfuls of olive oil.
3 big tea olive oil.
Teaspoon of freshly minced garlic.
A little tea. Finely minced
That's
garlic.
Right, finely minced. Finely minced and freshly minced. In other words, now don't use like garlic out of a container in this case. Use fresh garlic because it's going to taste different. Mm-hmm. Quarter of a teaspoon of dried hot red pepper flakes.
Quarter little tea dried hot pepper. I'm sorry.
You go ahead. Go for it. Try it again.
A quarter little tea dried hot red pepper flakes.
Now try saying that.
Say that.
I was going to say like Peter Piper picked this exactly. By the way, be very careful if you use. Yes. Go ahead.
And a little tea anchovy paste or 4 anchovies smashed into a paste.
Excellent. You know something? You got it, baby. You got it. You know, you got to be careful, by the way, with these red peppers, because once I sort of sneezed, I had allergies, and they went around the room. And let me tell you, there's nothing like red peppers in the air to ruin a whole environment.
Ooh.
All of a sudden, they go. Okay, so number one, cut off the broccoli florets. Okay, now you're going to take the stems, take the outside stems of the broccoli, because you've got the broccoli, take the outsides off, because they're woody. You're very woody. And then what you want to do is trim the outside of the stems and then the inside cut into 1/4-inch pieces and cut them kind of diagonally, not flat off, but diagonally. And they will work very nicely in this recipe. And you'll get about 6 cups, you know, which is about what you need. Okay, bring water to a boil. Cover the broccoli when added. Add a little bit of salt pieces. Cook for 3 minutes on the clock. Look at it, 3 minutes. Don't do it for 5 minutes. It'll be mushy. Don't do it for 10 minutes. It'll be mushier, about 3 minutes. In the meantime, heat some oil in the skillet. Add the broccoli after you heated the oil for maybe about a minute or two and stir it over a nice high heat. Then add the garlic and pepper flakes and anchovy paste. And you can do this after you add the broccoli, or you can do it to the oil right away. You know, so you mix it kind of in the oil and then add the broccoli, toss it together, stir in the ingredients for about a minute, you're done. Put it on the plate. Delicious. Delicious hot, delicious at room temperature too. And it's great. I like this recipe. Simple, easy, tasty way to use broccoli.
And if you'd like a copy of this recipe, you can dig back in the New York Times.
Find the right paper. Or you can write us a letter, but we won't answer you because we don't have any money for stamps these days. Or you can go to our website, ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget Facebook. And I do tweet from time to time, but it's more of a musical tweet.
800-462-7413, that number. That's 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba, a listener with us in Minnetonka, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
Good, good. My parents came to this country after World War II, and a lot of my family died in the war, so I don't have a lot of relatives. The 23andMe, the idea of getting my genetic test done really intrigued me. So I did it. I got the results back, and I was very taken aback that I was 99.6% something.
Something. Okay.
Something. I figured somebody along the way would have gotten together with somebody else and I'd be half this or a third that. And so I was sort of proud. I'm like, oh, I'm a purebred. And then I thought.
A purebred. I got it. You know, like the American Kennel Club or like ours. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Exactly. But then that's exactly what happened. I thought we have a dog. And it's a mix of a dog. And so we talked about a purebred and we thought, well, purebreds have problems. So then I started to worry a little bit.
Sure.
This isn't so
Well, I'll tell you, Seth, you know, you bring up a really good point. The point that you bring up is over-testing. That's the point that actually, the broad avenue what this is. So here it is. You did 23andMe. You expected that somebody had sex with somebody outside of that area. So you have a couple of assumptions here. Number one, you assume the test is true, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, right? Every test has errors to it, and you're 99.9%, 100% pure like Ivory soap. And, you know, my mother would use Ivory soap because it floated. What did that mean? That means they put air in the soap. That's all it meant, but she thought it was pure. Pure what? Pure Ivory soap, and it was white, and that was like the most popular soap, and that was just an advertising gimmick. So, yes, you're pure in one way, but even though 23andMe didn't differentiate things, it really doesn't mean that you are genetically dissimilar so that you have problems being a purebred, because it doesn't tell how many people within the last 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 generations had sex with each other, which were outside the immediate family. That's really the problem. The problem is when you have a cohesive environment, maybe of 1,000 or 2,000 people, and they all have sex with each other and they don't go outside of that. That's where you get recessive genes.
Like in Iceland.
Yeah, but the Icelandics are, yeah, it is kind of like in Iceland. But I don't know how much they have in recessive genes. And also Iceland, it's a tiny country. It's like 300,000 people. I mean, it's smaller than Minneapolis and St. Paul. Mm-hmm. You know, so you're dealing with that. And I don't know what sort of genes that are that have problems with in Iceland. But, yeah, like in Iceland, they all ended up getting their genes done. But they're pretty good. I don't think of Icelandics as being unhealthy. So they must have enough diversity within their genetic population. So okay. It may not be like Iceland. It may be like a town that has 100 people or 200 people. Because you bring up a really good point. Iceland has 300,000 people, and they're all having sex with each other, maybe not every day. But they're all having children. And Thomas laughing. They're all having children with each other, and they're not having genetically disfigured children. So there's enough diversity within the Icelandic population because they're healthy and they're tall, and they live a long life and they read a lot. Maybe it's because they read a lot that they're so healthy. They're the most literate people in the world.
So what I'm hearing is I should be okay at 99%. 0.6% something as long as I read a lot.
That's exactly right. Start reading and listen to public radio, and you'll be fine.
Good.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Will do.
We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413.
But, you know, it's such a point that all of a sudden we get a test, and then we look at the test, and then we think about the test. Mm-hmm. Then the test produces problems, like, you know, our gentleman who was then worried because he's 99.9%, 100% pure something. Pure something.
800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is with us from Sparta, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how can we help?
Well, a few weeks ago, Zorba was talking with a caller about shingles, and he had mentioned a test about for people who had not had chickenpox in their life.
Mm-hmm.
I am 44 years old. I have never had chickenpox.
Uh-huh.
I've been exposed repeatedly to it. I've never had a chickenpox vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
But I was curious as to what this test was, what would be the advantage to being tested, and also, is there a natural immunity to chickenpox that I may possibly have?
Well, good questions. So first of all, you know, 98% of the people who have never, you know, before immunization, who have not had chickenpox, get chickenpox when they're exposed to it. But some, you can have been exposed to chickenpox and had a pock. In other words, you could have actually been a young child and actually there was a sore or there were two sores or three sores. And that is actually pretty common, where moms will say, you know, I don't remember, I don't think you had chickenpox, because you had such an absolutely mild disease, because you developed this robust immunity very quickly, that you may have had a pock or two. And the way of knowing is a blood test. It's a really simple blood test, which sees whether or not you developed immunity. And if you developed immunity, then that means you actually came in contact with the virus. Now, the issue is, if you have never, you don't have any immunity to chickenpox, should you get the chickenpox vaccine? Because if you get chickenpox as an adult, it's really awful. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible situation. So my recommendation would be if you haven't had chickenpox, you get vaccinated. You don't get the shingles vaccine, you get the chickenpox vaccine, which keeps you from getting chickenpox. So the shingles vaccine, and I'd have to look at the CDC, and I obviously don't have it in front of me, mm-hmm. but the recommendation is really to make sure you get immunity to chickenpox because you don't want to get it at the age of 40 or 45 because you can get a chickenpox pneumonia that can be deadly. It can be awful. And all of a sudden, you know, we don't see much chickenpox around anymore because kids are vaccinated. But the reality is if you come into contact with somebody with shingles and open sores, that is a chickenpox. I mean, that they're not breathing it, but if you touch it and they have a sore, you can then get it in. So I would recommend getting a blood test. Well, the first thing I would recommend is calling your insurance company and seeing if the blood test is covered. That's one of the things, because you might be stuck with a bill. I don't know what it costs, but these tests are usually a couple hundred bucks. But I would call them up, or I would check with the CDC. If people ask me if they've had it, I'm thinking back. When I have people in my office, and they go, I'm having kids, I don't think I had chickenpox, I do the blood test automatically. But I never answer insurance questions. I never know if it's covered. I always tell people to call their insurance. So.
Sure. That makes sense.
I would definitely get vaccinated, or I would get checked to be vaccinated beforehand.
And if I were to get vaccinated having actually had it as a child and not knowing it, there's no danger there?
No, but I don't think that the standard of care is you get vaccinated without actually checking you for immunity. I would do that because we don't give the vaccine because if you're 40, yeah. What I do is I always look at the guidelines. I'm thinking out loud right now, and I don't have the guidelines in front of me. I always go, so you can do this because I don't have a computer in front of me. Go to cdc.gov and put in varicella, or go to Google and Google not vaccinated CDC recommendations or no chickenpox CDC recommendations, and look at what the CDC recommends. Okay. And I would follow that exactly because they're very good. They're very judicious because there are risks and side effects, and I would follow what they said. That's what I would do.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. Before the break, Zorba, we love it when our listeners post on our Facebook page. So let's fire up Zorba's favorite theme song, time again for Facebook Feedback.
Facebook Feedback.
You ready, Zorba?
I am.
First, a listener, Joseph in Rice Lake, Wisconsin, writes, Zorba, my wife is pregnant, and we are discussing the vaccinations for the baby. What do you think about the vitamin K shot given after birth?
Oh, vitamin K shot after birth is very important because there's a certain number of babies who actually have hemorrhagic disease. They actually start bleeding. Vitamin K is excellent. Babies should have it.
Next, Jenna asks, Hi, Zorba. My father is a patient with cancer. Recently on NPR, I heard that taking a probiotic enhanced the effectiveness of cancer treatment. Which probiotic do you recommend my dad take?
Oh, I'm not sure which probiotic to take, but I've read some information on it. Not a lot of good research. No harm done. No harm, no foul. I would just take a lactobacillus. Yogurt is the best natural probiotic you can get. Cheap, inexpensive, tasty.
Now Zeke asks, does cracking your knuckles cause arthritis?
Not at all. That's an old mother's tale because they're sick of kids cracking their knuckles. And when you crack your knuckles, what's actually happening is there is a gas within the joint. And when you crack the knuckle, you're actually causing pressure in the knuckle and the gas gets released and makes a sound. That's what the sound is, the sound of gas popping. You could sort of think of it as a fart for the knuckle.
Does it do anything to hurt your knuckles as
Not at
you
all.
Age?
Not at all. Do you crack your knuckles?
I don't.
Oh, well, you should. Try doing it. See if it bothers you.
Let me see.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Hey.
Yeah. I didn't know I could do that.
Hey, oh, not bad.
That's kind of fun.
See, I can't. My knuckles never crack. I can't do it. Can't do a thing about it.
Okay, Zorba. This is from Kelly.
This is really funny.
Kelly writes, Zorba, I'm asking for a friend. Can high blood pressure pills and medication cause dementia side effects?
Well, It does not cause dementia. Does it have side effects? Sure. Some can have side effects. Some can fall. Some can be dizzy. You want to make sure your blood pressure is appropriate for your age. The medications work and have minimal side effects. They do not cause dementia. Zero.
And finally, Zorba, a few weeks back, you posted a photo of yourself wearing a Christmas-themed suit. I'm showing it to you, although you've seen it a million times. Okay, here's a sampling of the comments it sparked. Mary Jean in Illinois wrote, "I saw those Santa suits in a department store recently, and I wondered who'd ever buy and wear those. Now I know. Is this why you're on the radio and not TV?" Eric in Dallas, Texas wrote, "I should get a free physical for having to see that suit." And finally, Judith wrote, "Now I can never unsee that. My eyes, my eyes."
It's very funny.
Let's keep the Facebook love coming. You can always send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
More calls to come. We have another interesting topic to talk about and our Medical Mythbuster segment, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number is 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. But first, Zorba, calcium and vitamin D supplements may not protect against bone fractures.
Well, the issue, and this is not a minor issue, it's a major issue because people take calcium all the time for bone fractures, is how much does it work and does it really work? And this is a new study. I've been talking about calcium for a long time. Mm-hmm. New study, which was a study of studies, you know, which looked at epidemiologically whether or not taking calcium and vitamin D would actually prevent hip fractures. And for the most part, the answer is it doesn't look like it does. Now, as I say it, it doesn't look like it does. In other words, we've got no absolute here. Now, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, they're very influential. They're very conservative. They rate recommendations, and they are very conservative when they rate them. And they rate this as probably not or possibly. In other words, it's in this really gray zone that it's not doing very much at all. And people take calcium and they go, "Hey, I'm taking calcium and vitamin D. I'm okay. I'm not going to fracture my bones." And the answer is no. The answer is, what shall we do? And it may be that supplements are not the answer.
Yeah, but does that mean we shouldn't be taking?
Well, I think there are a few things about. First of all, the most important thing to prevent bone fractures are stop smoking if you smoke. Mm-hmm. Get regular exercise that is weight-bearing exercise. That's walking, running, anything that's actually using your body is good. Dancing. Learn balance so you're less likely to fall. And if you're likely to fall, you're not as likely to fracture your hip. I was going into the garage yesterday. I rarely fall. All of a sudden, I slipped and fell on my buttock, on my butt. And it hurt me for a while, but I didn't fracture my bone because I exercised on a regular basis. Exercise is the issue. But the other issue is there's some evidence that it may not be calcium supplements that we need, but we need to take calcium-containing foods. Mm. Now, if you eat dairy, it's easy. Container of yogurt is about 400 milligrams. You need about 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams a day of calcium. A container of yogurt and then other foods that also have calcium will be worthwhile. And vitamin D, the jury's still out on. The wide brush is that vitamin D prevents everything from heart disease to bone cancer to schizophrenia, and that certainly is not true. But I think people rely too much on calcium supplements and not enough on exercise. I think that's really what we're looking at.
But it's might okay. It might help.
I'm going to fit with the U.S. Public Service Task Force. The article said it doesn't work. The U.S. Task Force says it probably doesn't work, but it may work. Taking a calcium tablet 500 milligrams a day is okay. Not more than 500 milligrams a day with vitamin D. But don't rely upon it. Exercise, yogurt, diet, that's what counts.
800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. 800-462-7413. And now Zorba listener joins in from Friendship, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello, how are you today?
Fine, how can we help?
Okay, I have a question. It's actually a series of questions having to do with I have a 21-year-old grandson who has a rather severe blood clot that has not responded to any treatment whatsoever. He's on blood thinners, but he still gets severe swelling in his leg. He gets pain. If I could give you just a little history, would that be helpful?
Sure.
Okay, the history is back in early May, he had pain in his groin area. He was coughing. He went to the doctor. They diagnosed him with a pulled muscle of some sort.
Sure.
And pneumonia. And nothing seemed to help. The pain continued to get worse and worse and worse. They did an ultrasound on his leg and found a blood clot that reached from mid-calf up into his groin, and he had embolism in his lung.
Got it. So,
causing the coughing.
Did they test him for a coagulopathy? That's where you have abnormal clots genetically. That's usually one of the tests they would do.
I'm sure they did. Simply because they've done about every test one can imagine.
He
spent 2 weeks in the hospital in Madison at St. Mary's.
That's a long time.
It is, yes. Mm-hmm. He was out for about 2 weeks, and he had a relapse. He was back down there for another week.
Wow.
Back and forth and back and forth all summer long.
Sure.
In fact, he is currently in the hospital right now.
Mm-hmm.
What he has is a mild-ish sort of May-Thurner syndrome. Mm-hmm. He has had, over the course of his life, some abuse to his left leg.
Mm-hmm.
He, as a youngster, he was a catcher in baseball, so he was down in a squatting position a lot. We're basically grasping at straws. He spent quite some time at St. Mary's.
Sure.
He spent time at UW not very long back. Mm-hmm. They tried to get in there. They were unable to do that. So the clot is there, period.
A clot itself doesn't necessarily cause a problem. The problem is caused when pieces of the clot break off and go around the body. And so when people get deep vein thrombosis, which is a big clot, in a standard way, not in your grandson's way. He's kind of a horse of a different color. We don't go in and get rid of the clot. What happens is the clot, fibrin forms around the clot. The body takes the clot. And usually, you know, circulation improves and goes back to normal. And that's the way the body does. But we don't get rid of the clot. But your grandchild has something, obviously, that's very, very different. So it's unusual to even be hospitalized in this day and age for clots and being hospitalized repeatedly. So just let me give you some overall advice. First of all, he's getting good medical care. He's in Madison, Wisconsin. Care is great in Madison, Wisconsin. You know, St. Mary's is a really good hospital. You know, full disclosure, that's my hospital that I use. But also, he was at the University of Wisconsin, and I'm sure they're looking at all of the possibilities of what they can do. And that's where it's at. It's now a matter of your making sure psychologically supporting your grandson during this. He's only 20, and all of a sudden he's in the hospital, and he's really bummed out. Why did this happen to me? And he can't do anything until they basically figure out what to do to stop the clot from giving him problems and doing that. And I don't have an answer to what they can do. But I do have an answer of what you can do, which is really to support him and help him psychologically that can make a difference. Was he in school or was he working? What was he doing?
He was working. He's a nursing assistant at a local nursing home here.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're supporting him psychologically. That's your job. And you sound like you're doing a great job at it. You're doing just what you have to. You're in a good institution. You're in a good job. The chances are really, really, really good that they're going to figure out what to do. And they've been trying different things, obviously, without success. But you've got technology on your side. You know, things are much better than they were 10 and 20 years ago with this. And the fact that they're consulting also at the university, I think, looks forward to this. So
Okay, there is one other situation. His body is growing collateral veins. Mm-hmm. I realize that's a long process.
No, but it happens right away. It's a process that goes around right away. That's exactly how the body ends up taking care around the clot. The body says, hey, we've got to get more nutrition over here and over there. And keeping him nutritionally up to date, especially when he gets out of the hospital, following a more Mediterranean diet, which is the king of diets, the best thing you can do, that's good stuff for him. And that's how it is. And then exercising, there will be exercise that he can do, and that's the exercise he should do. And you guys can help him with that to make sure that he does the right exercise and doesn't do the wrong exercise.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your time ever so much.
Sure.
And we will keep on keeping on.
That's exactly it. You're doing a great job. You're doing a great job. Keep doing it. Everyone should have a caregiver like you.
And we appreciate that call, too, at 800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, time again now for our Medical Mythbuster segment. Today's question comes from a listener named Robert. Dr. Zorba, I want to point out that while shaving your armpit doesn't reduce sweating for those of us with forests under there, it helps the antiperspirant work better if you shave. I discovered this after sweating miserably through many winters. My best guess is that it is much easier for the antiperspirant to come in contact with your skin to prevent sweating. What do you think?
Well, I'm not exactly sure. I don't think you have to shave your forearm to do it. I think probably the best thing to do is to change antiperspirants and go to a spray antiperspirant. Sprays are an effective way to actually get through the hair that's in there. So, you know, I think it's a myth that you have to do this. On the other hand, if you want to shave the hair underneath your forearm, underneath your armpit, shave away. I see that in the office more and more. I see men shaving not only their armpits, but men shaving their genitals also. And that's become a much more common thing in the millennial generation.
Have a potential myth for Zorba. No sweat. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Another caller coming up now, Zorba, a listener with us in Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, it's a strange thing here. A couple of weeks ago, I was out rummaging in the snow because I had dropped my house keys in the snow and couldn't find them. The bottom line is I froze my hands to the bone from the wrist down. Mm. When I eventually got in the house, it was a very difficult thing, and that was the story all itself. But anyhow, when I got in the house, I must have had hypothermia, so it took me 3 hours to stop shivering. I sort of rubbed my hands together. I didn't put them under hot water or anything like that. My question now is, I don't seem to have control over my fingertips when it comes to things like tying up shoelaces and threading needles and so on. And I have a tingle in my fingers that I never used to have.
Uh-huh.
And my hands cannot take the cold like they used to.
Yeah.
I never wore gloves, but now I have to put gloves on if I, you know, blow on my hands. So
how long were you rummaging in the snow?
Oh, a good 40 minutes or more.
So you were going through the snow without gloves for 40
right.
minutes. So you were producing frostbite on your fingers. That's obviously what you were doing.
Well, more than my fingers, my hands. I had lost all feeling from the wrist down,
yeah.
And I froze part of my face, too.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Well, and how long? So this was how many weeks ago was this?
About
2 weeks. Okay. So, first of all, your body is now still in a healing condition. You had frostbite. There's no doubt about it. You came in. You were obviously chilled to the bone, as you said, came in the house. Your body shook because that's the way you increase your body temperature. Getting in a hot shower would have helped, or a warm shower, not super hot, would have helped, but you took care of that. But as far as the numbness and everything and the side effects, because you have frost nip, not frostbite. It's called frost nip. It should over time get better, but it may take a few months. It may not get better right away. It may take a few months. I highly recommend when you go outside now Absolutely, wear gloves. Now you may
have to wear gloves.
You may have to do it for the rest of your life, but you certainly have to do it for the rest of the wintertime. There's no doubt about that. You got to wear gloves to protect it. And there's something
what
else.
What is the difference? What's the difference between a nip and a bite?
Well, it's just the amount. It's just the amount of chilling that you actually occurred. I mean, with frostbite, tissue actually dies. I mean, it actually dies. It has necrosis and it produces much more problem. And your tissue didn't die, but clearly. You affected the nerves, you know, the nerves adversely. But the tissue did not. But I have another suggestion. So you were in the house. Are you married?
No. Well, no. I'm a widow now.
You're
I'm
a widow.
Alone.
So if your wife were there, what would she have said if you were outside rummaging for 40 minutes in the snow?
She would have called me in the house. I could have gone in the house.
Yes, exactly. And she would have called you in the house and said, come on in. So you got to picture your wife as always being there so you don't do things like this again.
Okay. Well, all right, doctor. Thank you very much for your help.
Thanks so much for that call at 800-462-7413. Before we sign off, Zorba, we love it when our listeners chime in with helpful information or interesting ideas. This email relates to a recent show where we were talking about mocktails, cocktails without the alcohol. But first, Brad, can you play our mocktails theme again?
Mocktails, ooh!
Okay, this is from Nomi, who listens to the show on WBAA in Lafayette, Indiana. She writes, Dear Zorba, I love your show and listen weekly. When I was a teetotaling bartender, I often experimented with non-alcoholic recipes. The best one I came up with, I dubbed nougat. Remember those Brock's candy that look a little like white rectangles with red and yellow gummies embodied in them? This drink tastes just like that. Okay, mix half a glass of orange juice with half a glass of pineapple juice. Add a dash of grenadine and a splash of cream or half and half. Voila! You have a nougat.
A nougat. I love it. I love that nugget of an idea to have a nougat.
Have a sweet tip for Zorba? Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org or, of course, through Facebook.
And don't forget you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Carl never sleeps. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, asking you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For more Zorba Pastor on Your Health, including episodes, recipes, and tips mentioned on the program, visit zorbapastor.org. This year, we're celebrating the show's 25th anniversary, and we want to hear from you. How has Zorba helped you out? What have you learned from the show over the years? Leave us a message at 800-462-7413.